Where's my headphones, everyone? For some reason, I don't have anything in my ears. Let's see if I can figure this out. Anyway, it's Tuesday, January 14th. You are turned into the Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Today is the day of the Democratic debate in Iowa, the last debate before the caucus. I recommend that you see it. So it's CNN, I believe, in the Des Moines Register. So just to give people a heads up on that. And, you know, I was walking out this morning, and it's in the 30s. It's slightly overcast, everyone. And as I was walking to the car, I felt so much better than I did on the day that it was 67 over the weekend. And I'm being told that we're going to see more and more of those sort of pockets of warmth over the course of the next couple of winters. And that absolutely, absolutely terrifies me. So I just want to let you know, suddenly there I am smiling going, it's 37. I love it. It's 26. I love it. So again, just to give you an idea of how climate change has changed my sort of reaction to weather should give you an indication of how we are. All right, everyone. So today we're going to be talking about two topics. And the two topics that we're talking about, I think will be brought up tonight during the course of the debate, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to address them. So I am doing this in anticipation of tonight's debate. One is on an issue of free college. And it's about looking in particular at the cost of community college and what the benefits of free community college would be. It was in an article at theconversation.com. The other one is a series of articles written by our good friend Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst. He wrote two pieces at Counterpunch, and they are very important in light of what's been going on with Iran. And I just want to remind everyone, he's also a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. But before we get to either of those things, in anticipation of tonight's debate between the last group of presidential candidates still out there, hanging out there, I wanted to read you something by the national politics reporter at the New York Times. His name, Stedman. And I guess he's at Asted Wesley. I'm not quite sure who he is, but anyway. A. Stedman. Buttigieg won the fresh face, not a lefty lane, which could have belonged to Harris or Booker. A lot of reasons why this happened, but this is also where the whiteness of the donor class and early states really matter. Their vision of electability impacts viability. So isn't this interesting? He basically sees Buttigieg winning that sort of, you know, moderate, middle of the road, you know, if it's not Joe Biden, who is it? And he really sees Harris and Booker as having had an opportunity to be those candidates or that candidate. But again, when you realize that the first two states are white, when you also realize that most of the donors are wealthy and white, it doesn't surprise you that the money would have gone to Mayor Pete. So I just thought I would throw that out there as we have this conversation looking into what's going to be happening tonight on the stage. So as I mentioned before, I do believe that in this debate in Iowa, you will see a number of things being discussed. Obviously, foreign policy is going to be discussed. So we're going to put that on at 12:30. But another conversation that's going to be looked at is the whole question of college, free community college and technical college, free four-year college. We've got people like Bernie and Elizabeth talking, really not only looking at student debt and forgiving student debt, they're looking at free four-year colleges. These are free four-year public colleges. But a number of candidates, and I believe Mayor Pete may be one of them, are looking at the possibility of doing something along the lines of community college and technical college. So I actually thought that that was a good idea. And then I read an article by a Dartmouth economics professor that was entitled, What Happens When Community College is Made Free? So, Bruce, oh, did I lose Bruce? Hold on. Bruce, do we have you? Hello? Bruce? For whatever reason, we lost him. Do we know what's going on? All right, everyone, we're going to sort of disconnect and find out what the story is. Did we lose him?
No,
that's Sacerdote. Well, we lost him, so I think we're going to have to try to grab him again. Let's try this. Bruce, are you there? Hello? Are you going to have to go back out and call him? Is Frank on the – he's on the phone with him? Okay. Sorry, everyone. We're trying to grab him. So in anticipation of the conversation about free community college, I did a couple of things. I looked at an article that I read, and the article that I read other than theconversation.com was looking at the cost of community colleges across the country. And as many of you know, this show originates in Concord, New Hampshire. So I'm looking at this graph, and it turns out that when you look at the basic cost to most students in states for community college, which state literally is off the charts when it comes to cost. But it turns out it's the state of New Hampshire. And if you go to my personal Facebook page, everyone, you will see this graph. And I think this graph is really, really important because we make certain assumptions. And the problem is the assumptions are, you know, what is the average? And then you find out that the difference between most states is that no state is named average. And the difference in cost and out-of-pocket expenses for students depends on geography and on location and on state. And in my state of New Hampshire, it doesn't come cheap. It becomes expensive. So let me see if we can grab our guest. He wrote a piece at theconversation.com entitled, What Happens When Community College is Made Free? His name is Professor Bruce Sacerdote. Is that correct?
That's right.
Very well. Well, thank you so much for joining us. So in anticipation of your call, I called a couple of community college presidents and professors this morning, and I said, so let's talk about this. So before I critique your article, I want you to give the arguments behind your article, because I read it, and it was surprising to me, some of your conclusions. But you are the economics professor, and you worked with two other people. So walk us through the premise of the article and what you found out about the benefits or the liabilities of free community college.
Sure, yeah. And I'm excited to hear what the community college presidents had to say.
Mm-hmm.
Our argument is actually quite straightforward when you hear it. And the data behind it is pretty straightforward. I mean, essentially, we're trying to test drive three or four different policies that candidates or policymakers might use to increase graduation rates and income in the U.S.
Right.
And there are many upsides to all these policies, and a lot of them represent a good investment. There's an obvious downside to free community college. And there are a couple obvious downsides in addition to the upsides. And one of the obvious downsides is that you'll draw people out of, by advertising it as free, you'll draw people out of four-year institutions who would otherwise attend and succeed at four-year institutions. And that could be all well and good, except that, you know, we know from other studies that people tend to pick up the graduation and success characteristics of the institution where they begin their education.
Mm-hmm.
And so our estimate suggests that, you know, you'd actually reduce the BA attainment rate by about one percentage point. You know, if, say, 35% of people are getting a BA now or 37%, that would drop down to 36 percentage points while driving up the associate attainment rate.
Okay.
So and I'm sorry, Arnie, I'll try to give you a chance to talk, but one last thing.
Yeah, of
this
course.
Is based not on a fantasy or sort of a mathematical, a theoretical model.
Right.
The inputs that go into this model are from the state of Tennessee and the state of Oregon, where they actually implemented this policy.
Okay. So there's a couple of things. When you begin to look at who attends community college, it turns out that 38 or 40% of them are the non-traditional student.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not the student that's coming out of high school. It's someone who's obviously been in the work setting, and they're juggling more than just leaving home and going to college, okay?
Right.
They're juggling
right.
families. They're juggling maybe looking for a new career. So in a lot of ways, even the face of a community college student isn't what we always think of. So the idea that more people might attend because it's free may not be a bad thing, especially when you're realizing it's a non-traditional student, and it's a student that probably has other responsibilities and has an other life, all right? So the idea of a four-year college, maybe they don't even imagine that. What they do know is they want new skills and they want to move into another job. And therefore, this freeness gives them choice and also takes some of the financial burden off, especially if they're trying to juggle another life. So that, I think, is important as you look at this. The other thing is that I talked to a friend this morning, and we were talking about the idea that there may be fewer people that attend four-year schools. So I'm just going to ask the question, is four-year college the gold standard or the old standard?
Right.
In the sense that you are, obviously, you're from Dartmouth, and I know I went to a four-year school, and my mother looked in the crib and said, my son and daughter, the lawyer, and we, you know, that was, the assumption was X, Y, and Z. I looked at my children, and I made none of those assumptions. And what I'm trying to figure out is that as you were looking at how many people accessed this technical or community college and how many people decided not to go on, is that necessarily a bad thing?
No, not at all. And so let me address your points very directly. So our study is very explicitly about traditional students. So we're not saying anything about the non-traditional students. And so I want to be very clear about that. We're talking about the potential reduction, potential increase in the number of associate degrees among the non-traditional and the drop in the BA rate among the traditional. We're talking about traditional in both cases. Now, and it is true that among the – there's two things one should keep in mind. The degree completion rate among the non-traditional students is relatively low. It's low among everybody, but it's particularly low for non-traditional older students. Mm-hmm. Another fact to keep in mind, this whole debate needs to be informed by the fact that community college is incredibly affordable already. And for lower-income folks and folks who make like $50,000 a year or less, it can be nearly free. I mean, the Pell Grant covers most of this already. So a different policy would be just explaining to non-traditional students, hey, look, there's a great opportunity out here for you. You know, there's already a great opportunity for you to attend at a low price, or maybe even a negative price where you get a rebate because the Pell Grant is larger than the tuition and fees.
Okay, but that again is the average. That's also an accident of geography. That's probably not true in the state of New Hampshire, where the Pell Grant doesn't cover it. Number one, number
right,
two,
it doesn't cover all of it. It covers a very large fraction.
Right, but then let's God. I hate figuring out financially whether I fit into something or don't fit into something. What are the requirements for the paperwork? What are the non-requirements for the paperwork? What if my income changes during the course of the 2 years? There's all these things that you sort of begin to negotiate that you have to start looking at. And when I was reading an article, actually at the Harvard Review, they were talking about community colleges. And one of the things you hear from professors and presidents is that the Pell Grant has not been refreshed, that it keeps in some ways stagnating and not growing with the actual cost of community college. So unless you're seeing your state writing bigger checks, which they are not, if the Pell Grant doesn't grow significantly, which it hasn't, then what you're beginning to see now is more and more of a greater burden put on these students. And the biggest reason why I worry about the fact that you looked at traditional students and non-traditional students, if 40% right now of those people that are going to community college are non-traditional, one of the biggest fears I think a non-traditional student has is, let's say I don't finish my degree. Well, I may be burdened with some aspect of debt, but I don't have the piece of paper. And that's because life got in the way. Isn't part of the value of not having to pay for this means that you can sort of negotiate going to school or dropping out of school or continuing in school without the burdens of debt? And I mean even debt because you don't even have that piece of paper, so you're doubly screwed. You've got the debt and you don't have the certification.
Sure. Right. Well, so Arnie, so let's talk about this a little bit. The amount of debt that we're talking about is quite low because community college, particularly after the Pell, it tends to be very affordable.
Okay.
We're not necessarily talking about large amounts of debt. You know, we're talking about people at the most, you know, maybe paying $1,000 a year towards their education, maybe $2,000, which, by the way, that's swamped by the actual, like, cost of living and housing expenses.
Of course.
Right? So if you want to talk about the true cost of attendance, it's not the tuition and fees anyway. Now, I agree with your point that if you advertise something as free, you'll get a lot more takers, and it does make life easier, right? Mm-hmm. I think all we're saying in our paper is there's a downside, too. So, like, look, we're not opposed to making that free, but I think, you know, if you look at some of the candidates who are kind of middle of the road on college policies, they're saying, like, look, we can't necessarily make everything free, right? If you want to declare, if you're going to declare community colleges free, okay, fine. Well, then maybe four-year public should be free too, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, we've probably decimated the finances of the four-year public institutions, right? And then, so, you know, we and then you say, well, healthcare should be free to everyone as well, so we could do that. So, you know, it's a question of what would you rather do with the money? And could you then, you know, we one of the alternative policies we talk about is, okay, what if you made four-year publics free for everybody who makes less than $60,000 a year? Mm-hmm. So there would be at least a bright line, mm-hmm. and the people who most need it, it would be made very clear to them that it's free. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you get a lot more bang for the buck if you do that. Right. So it's not a question of my co-authors and I being violently opposed to free community colleges. We're just saying, okay, what are some alternative policies? Where could you get more bang for the buck if you wanted to?
Well,
do that?
Well, one of the things you pointed out was that fewer people continue on for the 4-year degree. Maybe one of the things that then becomes the sort of the requisite or the burden on us is to begin to understand that if you provide free community college, that you actually begin to sort of explain to people the opportunity and the bridge to 4-year. So if you wanted a 4-year degree and we're going to end up spending $60,000, but you could get a 4-year degree because you have free community college and you could do it for $30,000, look what you get. You get a better bang for the buck. Sometimes part of the problem with the whole college conversation is that a lot of these kids that don't complete it or don't decide to pursue the 4-year degree, don't have the family supports, the background, the understanding of what it is to do. That's part of the problem with our system. We assume everyone comes in like a cookie cutter and is the same, but they come in with different needs. And yet when you get to college, everyone is sort of treated the same. And that probably is the wrong approach.
Right. So that gets to our deeper point, which is that so one of the projects that I – let me talk about another project and let me talk about how it relates to the current paper.
Okay.
What I really spend most of my time doing is working with community colleges on, okay, if we spent a little bit more money, how could we provide individualized help to students to help them either, you know, finish their associates, you know, make better have some better planning to help them get out the door with their associates, or if they want to transfer, help them transfer. So providing personalized help to students. And that, and so we've had a very successful program at White Mountains Community College where we've done exactly that, and you know we're now trying it in Indiana, and hopefully we're going to be trying it at other New Hampshire community colleges. So that to circle back to the paper that we wrote, one of the policies we consider is spending more money at public 2 years and 4 years. So rather than declaring everything's free and probably having less money overall to spend, and certainly less money per student, what if you actually spent more money? And, you know, we sort of grind through that math and we actually do better by providing more support to students. That could potentially outperform declaring it to be free and having less support for the average student. So that's kind of the thought.
So as you've been sort of negotiating these numbers, one of the other things that we probably will be hearing about tonight on the debate stage is not only the fight between community free 4-year college and 2-year college, but the idea of student debt. So what have we done because we've already screwed up? And this to me is just the burden on students. I refer to student debt as the anti-dowry, that you basically have decided to postpone life because, you know, you start out life at $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 depending on where you are or what you're trying to pursue academically. And that has produced significant burdens on so many people that they can't transition from, to some extent, even young adulthood to adulthood because of the cost. So as you have been sort of crunching the numbers and you don't want to give free, what about debt?
Right. And I should clarify, it's not that I don't want to give free. We're comparing free to other possible to other possible policies. And, you know, investing in education in general makes a lot of sense, tends to be a good deal for the government because we are somewhat underinvesting in post-secondary right now. And so there do tend to be decent payoffs to a lot of these investments.
Yeah.
Now, with regard to debt, I think a key fact, you have to keep in mind the distribution of it, right? So the vast majority, there's a tremendous amount of student debt out there, the vast majority of which is held by people seeking professional degrees, people who've completed their 4-year degrees. There are, I think the people that one worries about are the folks who are induced into taking out large debt contracts and never complete a degree degree in something that's not necessarily going to pay, you know, that's not going to have a big return, right? And so I do agree. We need to. I think some of the studies showing that that people respond very much to how much debt you offer them. So if we can offer them less, and they can find a way to get through and get through in a more affordable fashion, I think that can really help. So I'm certainly open to the ideas of debt forgiveness, having debt debt forgiveness that's scaled to people's income, and also kind of modifying the way in which we offer loans to students. I think those are all good ideas.
So the idea of paying for free college, let's just say this, is that, you know, obviously maybe we should tailor it to make it more income sensitive, those kinds of things, something that I don't always feel very comfortable with. I mean, I look at the fact that everybody gets their Social Security check, no matter whether they're a gazillionaire or whether they're not, in part because we've all paid into it, but then we all receive it, so we're all sort of in the same boat together.
But we receive it in a way that's progressive, right? So I'm going to, as a proportion of the money I pay in, I'm going to receive a lot less than someone who's poor. So even in that example, there's a lot of progressivity to how it's done. So,
I hear you on that. But as I'm looking at this, so if we offered everyone the opportunity for free college, and yes, we'd have to invest a hell of a lot of money into this, but wouldn't there be a hell of a lot of benefit from this? Because if all of a sudden people are nimble, they can make these decisions. They can go when they need to go. They can respond to the changing economic environment where, you know, my grandfather had the same job for 50 years and I've had 50 jobs. And I look at the kind of skill sets I needed to acquire over the course of time. Isn't the idea of free, not just freedom for debt, but it's actually freedom to unleash an economy that needs people to be flexible at different times and different stages of their life. But when they go into the academic arena, especially because they're going to be non-traditional, they come with a whole new different set of needs than a 17-year-old.
Sure. So I think what you're describing is not a world with or without free community college. What you're describing is a world where we get more people to obtain a degree.
Okay.
And that's really what our paper is about. It's what's the best way to get there? Okay, what are some of the most cost-effective ways to get to a world where people do have more valuable degrees, they're more likely to complete, and that's really what we're talking about. So I'm with you that given the change in the economy and given the fact that only a modest fraction of people work in manufacturing now, and people do switch jobs with some more frequency, and there is a real complementarity between skills and capital, right? People need this human capital, and they need those skills. That's what we're talking about. What's the best way to get there? Where we got more completers, right? And so just declaring it free, it's not the worst idea in the world, and you will get more completers of a sort. But there's other ways. We actually need to spend more, not less, per student in our public colleges. And free tends to be it tends to be a way to spend less per student as opposed to taking the students we have already and spending more on them. That's the nature of the debate.
Well, so the other thing that I thought was fascinating is as we're talking about, you know, attaining a 4-year degree or completing the 2-year degree, the new shtick out there is not either. It's not a 2-year degree or a 4-year degree. The new idea is certification. And so I was talking to some folks at local community college, and that's now what people are seeking. They're looking for something more discreet. They're looking for something more specific. They look for something with – and it's just so ironic that she was mentioning certification, because my youngest daughter just applied for a certification at UVM. So even though she's talking about this – so in a lot of ways, it's part of the problem that we have an old headset on how we're viewing higher education. And therefore, when we're looking at 2 years free, 4 years free, maybe we need to look at the gestalt to say, what is the best investment, not only for people's lives, for the economy? And even if we're providing free, that maybe the payback will be awesome, because they're not going to be delaying making decisions about economic things like buying a house, buying a car, moving here, being an entrepreneur. Maybe the payback is greater than what the cost is.
Yeah, and I think that for a lot of the policies we look at, the payback is greater than the cost, even in the narrow sense of what does the government collect in terms of tax revenues once this person completes. But the real money, the real pot of gold is not how do we induce more people into the system by declaring something free that is already effectively very inexpensive, but it's how do we get more people through? How do we take the people who are there and get them through, or take the people who are there and help them find a degree or certificate that's going to be valuable in the labor force, and that's where the real pot of gold is, and that's what we're talking about.
So I wish we were having a debate tonight about education, because again, part of the problem is everyone has a headline, everyone plays out the headline, and no one actually offers the ability to have the kind of content that we need. So I'm grateful to you, Bruce. I still have a little reservations about your conclusions, but I think if nothing else, we need to slice this differently. We need to look at this differently, and the most important thing is that when we make the investment, we need to look at the consequence of that investment. And I think that's the part that I think is the most valuable. What is my result as opposed to just how much am I spending?
Right. I agree. And does it sound good on a bumper sticker or as, you know, in a soundbite? Instead of that, like, what's the evidence on how much this really helps people? I mean, that should be the – and unfortunately, debate formats don't necessarily – lead themselves to that sort of a deep discussion.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. I love theconversation.com. I'm glad you were writing for it. What happens when community college is made free? Bruce, pronounce your last name so I get to hear it myself.
It's Sacerdote, yeah.
Sacerdote. Bruce Sacerdote is a professor of economics at Dartmouth in Hanover, New Hampshire. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Arnie. Have a great day.
You too. Ciao. Yeah. All right, everyone. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1868. Representatives from more than 40 locals of the International Union of Bricklayers of North America gathered in New York City. It was the third annual convention of the new union. Members of Local 4 from New York City came to the convention to push for support for the 8-hour day. They also called upon the other unions to stand with their local if they went out on strike to win the 8-hour day. After the Civil War, the idea of an 8-hour workday had increasingly become a rallying cry for workers. Skilled craftsmen, such as bricklayers, would help to lead the charge. In 1910, Johns Hopkins University published a report on the bricklayers' contribution to this important labor struggle. According to their report, the convention decided not to press the 8-hour question at that time. Although the resolution for the 8-hour day had not become a part of the union's formal platform, there was growing member support for the cause. That year, Local 4 went out on strike to win the 8-hour day. They were joined by New York Locals 2 and 12. The young union had little experience with leading such an action. But as the report points out, the workers were, quote, routed and all, but went to pieces. The flame of the idea of the 8-hour workday continued to spread across the international. By the next year's convention, it had caught fire. The resolution for the 8-hour workday was adopted and became an official demand of the Bricklayers Union. 4 years later, the New York locals again went out on strike. This time, the more experienced unions found success. And as the report concluded, in just one day, the men won the shorter day on their own terms. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. China burns more coal than any other country, and it's not only bad for the climate. China's air pollution causes more than 1 million early deaths each year. But several years ago, air quality in some large Chinese cities started to improve. Journalist Beth Gardner is the author of Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. She says part of the reason for the improvement was that the Chinese people, particularly those in the urban middle class, started speaking up.
Around 2012, 2013, there came a real upswelling of public anger.
She says the government started to feel threatened by public unrest.
Consequently, they started to respond and actually do things that have started to really push the air pollution down significantly.
For example, the government capped coal usage near urban areas and invested billions of dollars in wind and solar power. The country is still heavily reliant on coal.
China has a very long way to go, but what we do know about air pollution is that any increment of improvement literally translates very directly into fewer heart attacks, fewer strokes, less cancer.
So switching to clean, renewable energy can save lives. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
what you doing? You're on the road to ruin. You know you better watch your step. You're soon gonna be needing help. You won't hear rhyme or reason. You think that's out of season, but don't try to walk away. Not until I've had my say. Remember, baby, back in 58, you tried to tell me you were going straight. Now here we are, 1964. You want me to sit around and take some more? You don't care who you step on. You think you got a secret weapon, but when your luck runs out, you'll know what I've been talking about.
Everyone, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We're hoping to connect with Mel Goodman. He's the senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He's a professor of government at Johns Hopkins. He's a former CIA analyst. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. He also wrote a book called A Whistleblower at the CIA. And his most recent book is American Carnage, The Wars of Donald Trump. So as I was getting ready for this show, I realized that tonight one of the biggest discussions that they're going to have is going to be about foreign policy. And that's in part because of what just happened with Donald Trump and the assassination of Soleimani, and now what we're seeing with Iraq asking us to remove our troops from Iraq. And then we're looking at all the protests that are going on in Iran. And then we saw the Ukrainian plane that went down. And it's just – it's chaos. And the other thing that's chaotic about this administration is that nobody has given us a straight answer as to why we assassinated Soleimani. It changes by the hour. At least George Bush, when they went into Iraq, they were all offering the same lie, and they were all using the same script. Okay, that's the part that is quite remarkable. But what we get with this administration is, unfortunately, we don't get the same lie and we don't get the same script, and that becomes problematic. So as I was looking at the two articles that Mel Goodman wrote for Counterpunch, I pulled out two paragraphs, and I want to read them to you while we're looking for Mel. And here they are. Trump and his national security team have racked up a series of policy failures. Iran is free to resume its nuclear activities. U.S. forces may have to leave Iraq. U.S. forces in Syria are more vulnerable. The Islamic State has greater freedom of action, and the United States has sent more troops to the region to conduct force protection. Washington's unwillingness to withdraw forces from Iraq, even if that is demanded by a sovereign state, will give China, Russia, and North Korea more propaganda leverage against the United States. On the basis of judging presidential leadership, such as political skill, cognitive style, vision, public communications, organizational skill, and emotional intelligence, Donald Trump is certainly the worst president in U.S. history and most definitely unfit to serve. Can I just read that sentence one more time? And I want to read that sentence so everyone who is a Republican, who's ever known me, everyone who sits as an elected member of Congress, let's think about this, because this is about the stability not only of the United States. It is about the stability of the world. Let me read that statement. On the basis of judging presidential leadership, such as political skill, cognitive style, vision, public communications, organizational skill, and emotional intelligence, Donald Trump is certainly the worst president in U.S. history and most definitely unfit to serve. There has never been a more incompetent or deceitful national security team in the service of a president. When Professor Richard Hofstadter wrote about the paranoid style in American politics because of his apprehension about the rise of right-wing extremism after World War II, he could not have imagined the rancid syndrome that now characterizes U.S. national security policy. So this is chaos. As we hear from him over and over again, he knows more than his generals. Obviously, he doesn't know more than his generals. He doesn't know anything. But this is not about foreign policy. This is about Donald Trump's reelection theory. And that is what makes us all so vulnerable and the world feeling so much more insecure. Joining us right now by phone is Mel Goodman. Again, he is the author of two articles, and the articles were entitled Trump's Latest Debacle as Incompetent and Deceitful National Security Team, and the other one was The Incoherence of U.S. Policy in the Middle East. Welcome to the program, Mel, and prepare us for what we're going to hear tonight, because you know tonight is not only going to focus on foreign policy, but I think the real issue is going to go back to how did you vote on the war in Iraq, because that really is going to be the test between the Joe Bidens and the Bernies.
That's a dumb test.
I totally agree. I totally agree. But I'm telling you right now, you know that that's what it's going to come down to.
I know. And it's not a strong group on national security policy to begin with, but it's important that these issues get discussed.
Right.
And they should be in the context of the spending we're doing on the military anyway, which has gotten bipartisan support. So there's a lot to talk about.
So as we look at what happened in the last week and a half, which, as I said to you, the earth has shifted again. You mentioned that really one of the biggest problems we have is his national security team. So let's actually start with your more recent article and back from there, because we kept talking about the adults in the room. And apparently there are not only adults in the room, but there are people with foreign policy agendas in the room. And Donald Trump is this blank slate that they can write on.
Yeah, well, there's a certain irony here, because the first cabinet really consisted of general officers, you know, people like Mattis, Marine, four-star, Kelly, Marine, four-star, Flynn, Army, three or four-star, who's about to face a jail sentence. And then you even had H.R. McMaster, who was not a retired general, but an active duty general. And I was unhappy about that, and I wrote about that, saying this is the last thing the Founding Fathers wanted to see, all these general officers in positions that should be manned by civilians, but at least they had some moderating influence over Trump to a certain extent, Mattis particularly. But once John Bolton came in, the bomb thrower from Baltimore, as the National Security Advisor, Mattis had no access to Trump, and so he left, particularly after the Syrian decision. But really, Mattis was on his way out 6 months before that, because Bolton really blocked Mattis from getting to the president. But now we have civilians who really make up the war cabinet that I think Trump wants. And I say that because when you look at these sycophants, and I would start with the CIA director, Gina Haspel, who was promoting the idea of assassinating Soleimani, which is policy advocacy, which no CIA director should ever be involved in. That's in the charter from the 1947 National Security Act. Then you have the biggest sycophant of all, Mike Pompeo, who I think is just a total disaster, who has ruined the institutional voice of the Department of State and substituted his own personalized voice, which is one in favor of regime change. I noticed even Trump, when he spoke about Iran, uses the word regime, which I think is a put-down. He doesn't recognize Iran as a government or a governing entity. He calls it a regime, which has a temporary context to it. And then you have Robert O'Brien, a hostage lawyer, who now, to me, is a hostage at the National Security Council with no background whatsoever in international affairs. And then Mark Esper, as Secretary of Defense, who was Pompeo's classmate at West Point in the class of 1986. And there are other members from that class who are senior aides to Pompeo. So this is a dangerous group of sycophants who aren't going to challenge Trump. And then you have Trump himself, who is totally unpredictable, who lacks any kind of impulse control, who's paranoid, who's a pathological liar, suffering from malignant narcissism. So you put all of these characteristics together, and you have legitimate fears among the American people of, will this guy not only go to war, but will he even use nuclear weapons. I mean, I've talked to people now who have this feel, and it's fear, and it's not an irrational fear by any means. So this is just a terrible, unpredictable, unstable situation that's going to dominate the next year, I think, right up to the election.
So under your section in your article at Counterpunch, under the section entitled Policy, you write, the killing of General Soleimani has not only worsened Americans' Iran policy, it has added a new dimension to strategic instability in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. It's enhanced Russia's efforts to gain credibility in the region, caused controversy within the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the European community, and substituted anti-Americanism for the opposition to Iran that was dominating discussion in the Iraqi government. The major winner of Trump's policy is the Islamic State, as the U.S. military presence is now preoccupied with force protection because of the threat of war between the U.S. and Iran. So as we're looking at all this instability that's created, let me just ask a question that sounds a little bit quirky. When Iran shot down that Ukrainian plane, up until that point in time, I saw that sort of Iran was able to sort of rally around the assassination of Soleimani. But we already knew there was sort of this negative tension going on inside of Iran because of the economics, in part because of what's happened with the sanctions that Donald Trump has imposed on Iran. And now because of what we know was on that plane, which were significantly a large number of Iranians for that part, we are seeing something interesting change again. It is not anti-American. It's anti the Iranian government. So in a bizarre way, has this shifted again because of what Iran did vis-a-vis that Ukraine airline?
Well, there's a possibility for a shift here. And it's not only the fact that Iran, in terms of its incompetence, shot down one of its own commercial airliners, and one-third of the people on that plane were Iranian citizens. But as I warned in previous discussions that we've had on this subject, you know, Iran is looked at as a non-Arab power in the Middle East. There's always a certain amount of resentment toward Iran throughout the Arab world and throughout the Middle East. And even looking at the assassination of Soleimani, remember, to a lot of Arabs, he's considered a colonial overlord. They weren't grieving this loss of Soleimani. There was some support for him within the Arab world, but there are a lot of people who went out on the streets and welcomed the fact that this individual was assassinated by the United States. And then if you add the Iranian domestic situation, which is now tilted in favor of protesting the government and the actions of the government and the economy of the government, which is in a terrible, terrible state with no sign of improvement whatsoever, that Iran probably has been shocked into some kind of at least recalibration of its policies in the Middle East, because whereas our policies in the Middle East aren't working, and I think the decision to kill Soleimani was sort of the trifecta of stupidity when you think of all the interests that have suffered that are our interests. But Iran's expansion of power into Syria and Yemen and Iraq, this isn't helping the people of Iran either. So there's going to have to be some recalibration of policy, I would hope, in both Washington and Tehran. Now, Tehran right now, I think, has more pragmatic leadership than we do. And I think there are greater chances that they will figure out what needs to be done over the short term and the long term than a government led by Donald Trump and this incompetent and deceitful national security team that doesn't even know how to get its lies straight in trying to explain the assassination in the first place. So I wouldn't assume that Iran's going to strike back, as all of these pundits are saying on cable television, and just about all of them have ties to American military-industrial corporations. When you think of all these retired generals who go on television who are working for Raytheon or working for Lockheed Martin or working for one lobbying organization or another in favor of a heavy military role. So this is a very delicate stage, I don't think Trump can manage it, and it's clear that O'Brien can't manage the National Security Council, and with Pompeo being a disaster at state and the absence of diplomacy on the part of the United States, still all of these vacancies at the highest ranks of the Department of State, vacancies among ambassadors.
Well, who would want to fill those vacancies?
Well,
I mean,
exactly.
anyone with a resume would not want to fill.
What seasoned expert
exactly.
would want to lend his support
exactly.
to someone like Donald Trump, who doesn't respect the people around him, who
yep.
never shows any loyalty to anybody, and is willing to throw anyone under the bus to save himself. And now in the midst of an impeachment trial, which may go a little better than a lot of the critics of Nancy Pelosi realize, if we get witnesses such as John Bolton to come in to tell the truth, which Bolton might do in order to enhance the sales of the
book.
He's not like he's a patriot who,
no.
who wants to tell truth to power.
No.
This guy wants to put money in his pocket.
Okay, so I'm going to make you the sort of the benevolent despot of the day. And why? Because I want you to sort of say, what should the conversation be like tonight between these candidates running for president? We know that foreign policy has now arrived on the scene. As I started this conversation, I said it's going to be dumbed down to how did you vote in the war in Iraq? And you're going to hear a lot of people like Biden and a number of other people saying, this is not the time to look back. This is about my knowing all the national, international leaders. This is about moving forward. This is about my being able to bring together a team, about making informed decisions. If you were to pose questions to these candidates tonight, what would you like to ask them? What do you want to hear?
Well, what I would like to hear is, where do we go from this point? Where do we go forward? There's no point in looking back. We've made a series of mistakes over a 20-year period. Clinton made them. Obama made them. George W. Bush certainly made them. But how do you go forward? How do you go forward in terms of military spending? How do you go forward in terms of getting rid of the Space Force that got bipartisan support for one of Trump's nuttiest ideas? How do you go forward in terms of what should be our presence in the Middle East? You know, Trump came in saying he wanted to end these endless wars and reduce the American presence in the Middle East. Well, we still have 14,000 soldiers in Afghanistan. We have about 13,000 in Kuwait, another 13,000 in Qatar, 3,000 in Jordan, 50,000 to 100,000 in Syria.
Wow.
Iraq, we have 5,000. I mean, it's a number that needs to be addressed. We're much too visible, much too involved, and we have to get back to a diplomatic discussion with Iran. That's going to be very difficult at this point in time, but Iran is the key player, not only in the Persian Gulf, but in the Middle East right now, even in its position of weakness. And certainly when you look at the Iran nuclear accord, which Trump blew up, this was the major source of hoping for some kind of stability in the Middle East that Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry put together. That's now on its last legs, as Iran is now threatening to enrich uranium at levels beyond the nuclear accord because of the continued sanctions policy.
So that what happened in the last couple of days vis-a-vis Iran and now and obviously taking him out, Soleimani taking him out in Iraq, and Iraq now asking us to have all troops leave, which I think is interesting and exactly everything that Soleimani had wanted, which was the troops to leave Iraq. But as I look at this, is it also sort of diverting our attention away from really the sort of the big gorillas in the room, which is China, Russia, and North Korea? And how does this impact our relationship there? Because to a large extent, I think what just happened vis-a-vis Iran really has enhanced the stature of Russia. Which, you know...
Well, certainly it's enhanced the personal stature of Putin. Look what Putin did after all of this.
Look where he went to visit.
He went off to Damascus.
Yes.
He immediately developed policies with Assad that's going to lead to more brutality in Syria. Then he went into discussions with Erdogan in Turkey, and they've come up with a ceasefire plan for Libya, a problem that was really caused by Hillary Clinton in the United States with the ridiculous use of military force in 2011 in Libya has never been the same since. So Putin is now a major player who can talk to all sides in the region, which we can't do. They have good state-to-state relations with Syria, with Iran, with Israel, with Turkey. Our relations with Turkey are a mess. We have no relations with Iran. And frankly, Netanyahu is a problem for American relations, whether it's Trump or someone else in the White House. China has smartly stayed on the sidelines and has used its equities much more effectively than we have in the region. And North Korea realizes they can continue their nuclear policy because Trump has really lost a lot of leverage in this situation because he's mishandled symmetry and he's mishandled the general relationship with North Korea to begin with.
So you tell me that
a lot of these countries are just waiting Trump out and taking advantage of the instability in Washington and the America First policy, which is really making America last in terms of the international arena.
So you tell me we can't look back. All right, so I want to look ahead.
It's pointless to look. We can look back, but it makes no sense.
No. I hear you. What I'm trying to figure out is define looking ahead. Who would be on your team? Who do you turn to for guidance? How do you assess the military budget? What's about your relationship? I mean, we just saw that perhaps the Russians went in to that Ukraine energy company and maybe hacked it. I mean, there is so much happening at the same time. I'm trying to figure out how you even describe what looking ahead looks like.
Well, looking ahead to me means putting civilian control of the military back on the table. Now, the military is falsely blamed for these military confrontations. And to be fair, the military has never wanted this involvement in Afghanistan. They didn't want this involvement in Iraq, and they certainly didn't want it in Syria. But once you hand the baton to the military, they don't want to get out until what they see is victory, even though these are unwinnable situations and fool's errands for everybody. So if we're going to get out of Afghanistan, something we should have done about, 17 years ago, it should be done. And it should be done by a civilian leadership the way Gorbachev did it to the Soviet military when he gave them 1 year, and then he said, we're getting out. And that's what I would do with the military. You've got 1 year to try to stabilize the situation to the best of your ability, and then we're getting out of Afghanistan. This position in Iraq, where Iraq is now telling us to get out,
yes.
The parliament passed this non-binding resolution, and we have arrogantly said, we're not leaving. That's not what we're even going to talk to you about. Maybe we should get out of Iraq and allow Iran and Iraq to figure out a solution to the problem of the Islamic State. This will lead to greater Shia influence, but that's something we opened up by defeating Iran's enemies on the east in Afghanistan and Saddam Hussein on the west in Iraq. So I think we should have a lower role, lower visibility, less presence in the Middle East. And that's how I would go forward. But I would put on the table in terms of discussion, how do we rehabilitate situations with Russia and China? You know, Richard Nixon did us a favor with the trip to Beijing in 1972, and governments since Nixon have followed the idea of some kind of conciliation with China. Well, Trump has blown this up with his trade war and his tariff war, and he puts a dollar value on all American policy. He has no understanding whatsoever.
You saw what he just did with Saudi Arabia.
International negotiation.
Yeah, he said Saudi Arabia is paying us for the additional troops. I'm just sitting there going, everything is a dollar value,
not a
security
plan. Yeah, we'll leave the airbase once Iraq pays us for that airbase. It's all about money to him.
So before I let you go, Mel, you made a comment that the military knew that it was a mistake with Afghanistan. The military knew it was a mistake with Iraq. Does the military have any responsibility when they know that it's not winnable to come forward? Because the Afghanistan papers shows that we knew for a long time that we were lied to, that it was hidden, that we weren't given the facts on the ground. What is also the responsibility of the military when they realize it is not working?
Well, I think it's the same kind of responsibility that a civilian would have if there's a policy that is so objectionable and so abhorrent that perhaps it's reason to resign your commission. And I think of what Cyrus Vance did in the case of the terrible attempt to rescue hostages in Iran in 1979, when Vance went to Carter and said, look, I'm not going to resign now, but I do oppose the policy. And after the operation, whether it succeeds or fails, I'm leaving the administration. And that's what generals should have done with really go back to Vietnam when you talk about lying. Lyndon Johnson knew within a year that the policy was a disaster. We have the conversations he had with Senator Richard Russell, the head of the Armed Forces Committee in the Senate. So maybe if a chairman of the Joint Chiefs had the courage.
To walk away.
But remember, look what happened with Colin Powell. He was no longer in uniform, but he was the Secretary of State and the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs when Bush was going to go into Iraq, which Powell really opposed. But when it was clear the administration was going ahead, Powell just put on his three-piece suit and went to the UN and repeated all the lies that were written for him by the CIA Director Tenet and the Deputy Director John McLaughlin. So I know there's courage on the battlefield, but sometimes a general needs political courage, too, and can't be a part of the deceit.
And I need to let you go
on
that line.
Policy for the last 40, 50 years.
Courage on the battlefield, but maybe the greatest courage turns out to be the political courage they need when they know the policy is wrong. Because in the end, they're protecting so many people that will die on this battlefield.
Exactly.
Because
remember,
of the policy.
The secretaries of defense like Bob Gates, who claims he wanted to get out of Afghanistan, was still signing orders to send people to Afghanistan.
And on that note, Mel Goodman, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, professor at government at Johns Hopkins, writes for Counterpunch. His recent articles, The Incoherence of U.S. Policy in the Middle East, and, of course, The Latest Debacle, An Incompetent and Deceitful National Security Team. Thank you so much, Mel, for joining us.
Thank you, Arnie. Always good to be with you.
Always good to be with you. All right. We're going to end with my favorite from Aretha. We've got to thank everyone.
Just